My title is The Whole Function of Philosophy, and that comes from a passage in William James that I will read to you later on. But let me begin autobiographically. I'm an extremely fortunate person. At many previous stages of my life, it would have seemed absurd to predict that I should be invited to speak to members of a major professional association, to talk about my own career, and to reflect on the current state of the field. I'm going to devote most of my time this afternoon to the second part of the charge for a Dewey lecture, the reflection on the state of the field. But before I do that, I would like to indulge, if you'll excuse me, in a brief autobiography. My luck actually began before I was born. In the early 1920s, my mother, then a teenager, was diagnosed with juvenile, that is, type 1 diabetes. Around that time, in Ontario, two young Canadians, Frederick Banting and Charles Best, discovered how to isolate insulin. My mother survived, and she was able to weather the period during which doctors didn't know much about dosages and had great difficulty distinguishing between insulin shock and diabetic coma. After the Second World War, she became one of the first diabetic British women to give birth to me. I grew up on the south coast of England in a resort to which, as a friend of mine later put it, the rich old ladies retire to die and then forget what they came for. My ancestors belonged to the laboring and servant classes. They were tillers of other people's fields and attendants on the prosperous. My father left school at 12, my mother at 14, just before her diagnosis. The expectation for me would have been to leave school at 16. When I was 7, however, I had another piece of luck. Out of the blue, my teacher asked me whether either of my parents would be at home that afternoon. My immediate reaction was to wonder how I'd offended. As it turned out, he had come to explain that he thought I showed promise and to recommend that I apply for admission to one of Britain's great charity schools, Christ Hospital, founded in 1553 by Edward VI for the poor children of London. That opened the door to one of the best educations then available in Britain. At 15, in accordance with the then regnant British system, I was forced to choose three subjects in which to specialize. I was torn between pure and applied mathematics and physics on the one hand, and English, French, and German on the other. I chose the mathematical option. As my parents told me, it was practical and would enable me to get a good job. They were surprised when I later wanted to go on to university, since even at 18, I could have found work far beyond any opportunity that had been available to them. Persuasion was needed before they signed the forms required for my student grant. In those days, depending on family means, British undergraduates received funds from the state to cover their living expenses. I was given the maximum amount. Sadly, opportunities like that have become uncommon, a sign of the enormous regression that has occurred in educational policy on both sides of the Atlantic. So in 1966, I went up to Christ College, Cambridge, to read mathematics. During the next 2 years, most of my time was spent on music and theater. I wasn't exactly punctilious about attending supervisions, often sending my supervisors tickets for the plays or concerts with which I was involved. But fortunately, sometime in the spring of 1968, I did show up for one with the pure mathematics don at Christ, a kindly algebraic topologist I knew as Dr. Maunder. Surprised to see me, he offered a piece of advice. "You need to change subject," he said. "If you go on with mathematics, you'll end up like me. I'm only in Cambridge for the music." As I later discovered, his self-report was entirely accurate. Richard Maunder volunteered to introduce me to his friend, Michael Hoskin, a historian of astronomy. After a conversation with Dr. Hoskin, I decided to switch to history and philosophy of science for my third year course. originally intending to concentrate in the history of science, and particularly in the history of the mathematical sciences. In that third year, however, a book changed my life. It was Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Now, the principal philosophers who contributed to the Cambridge HPS program were on leave that year, so I had virtually no philosophical training. But I decided that what I wanted to do was philosophy of science. Quite by accident, I learned of fellowships to the United States for graduate study, offering what were to me vast sums, $2,000 a year. At the last moment, I applied and was successful. So in September 1969, I arrived in Princeton, intending to stay for a short time, 4 years, or maybe only two. That plan would change because of the greatest piece of luck of all. 1 year later, I met a young woman, a new graduate student in Princeton's philosophy department. In those days, people married a bit earlier than they do now, and since we've become quite ancient, I won't say how long it's been. Between my arrival and Pat's, however, came a very rocky first year at Princeton. To the shock of the people whose seminars I attended, I knew absolutely nothing about philosophy in the way it was practiced at Princeton. Fortunately, a few people, Clark Leymore, Dick Grandy, Tom Kuhn, and especially Peter Hempel, detected some spark of something and decided that what I needed was a serious education, which Princeton then supplied. The main task of knocking me into shape was undertaken by Paul Benasraf. His relentless demands for clarity gradually had an effect. Paul taught me how to think. He should not be blamed, however, if I've since forgotten. He also did me the enormous favor of steering me to a dissertation project quite different from any then standard at Princeton. One day, he summoned me into his office. "Tom Kuhn and I," he said, "don't agree on very much. But one thing we do agree on is that you should write your dissertation on the historical search for a foundation for mathematics." That was brilliant advice. Throughout my subsequent career, a prominent strategy of mine has been to try to liberate areas of philosophy from perceived constraints by considering the history behind our current practices. So I wrote an odd but passable dissertation, emerging as an okay, but by no means stellar student, into a job market that was already tightening. Although I must say, it was nothing like the difficulties that most of you, in fact, almost all of you have faced. Returning to the UK would have doomed Pat's chances of any academic future. Even in the US, however, the prospects for philosophical couples were bleak. When he heard of our intention to marry and our firm resolve to live in the same place, Paul remarked, "Don't think it's simply a matter of multiplying probabilities. No, no, they go down by some nasty exponential decay function." Our case has often seemed to us, and I suspect to many younger people, as simply one of dumb luck. That saddens us. We both hoped that more and more partners would be able to find jobs where they could live together. We didn't want to be seen as fortunate exceptions. We wanted to help change the culture. Although things are a bit better now, we still have a sense of having failed in this. For it's true, the two of us have had plenty of dumb luck. A first large slice came when Steve Kahn, in the midst of rebuilding the philosophy department at the University of Vermont, was prepared to entertain the thought that a couple from Princeton might help. We are immensely grateful to Steve and to all the subsequent chairs and faculty members who have smoothed our way at Minnesota, UCSD, and finally at Columbia. In the course of our odyssey, my philosophical focus has continually evolved, again, often as a matter of luck. I'd reached the age of 27 without learning anything whatsoever about biology. Then, in my first semester teaching at UVM, a student in my philosophy of science course came to my office hours. Shyly, he asked me whether in class I could offer some examples from sciences other than physics and occasionally chemistry. You see, he said, lots of us are pre-meds, and the science we know best is biology. I confessed to being thoroughly ignorant, but didn't tell him that biology had never registered either in my own scientific education or in my philosophy of science training. I immediately went to the university library, where I found David Hull's recently published Philosophy of Biological Science. Starting to read, I was hooked. 7 years later, after lots of further reading and many discussions with generous biologists, I headed off to Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology to spend my first sabbatical immersing myself in biology. Early in the 1990s, there was another fortunate shift in direction. I was invited to write a report on the ethical and social implications of the Human Genome Project. After making sure that accepting would enable me to spend most of my time with my family in Southern California, I agreed. During the year I spent on this, my interactions with eminent molecular biologists increased my respect for the power of the field. Even more crucial, though, were some visits to Washington. They opened my eyes to an obvious limitation of the philosophy of science I had been taught and that I had so far practiced. For years, my focus had been on the internal workings of science. Now, as I clearly saw, there were families of neglected questions about the embedding of scientific research in the societies that provide support for science. From that time on, I've been concerned to understand how science as an institution should fit in a democratic society. For 5 decades, I have received immense amounts of help, not only from the people I have mentioned, but from many others. While I was a graduate student, I was aided by 2 people who have left a large impact on my thinking, Richard Rorty and David Lewis, 2 very different philosophers. Until their untimely deaths, David and Steffi Lewis were mentors and also lifelong friends. So too have been many other philosophers, some whom I've taught as undergraduates, the graduate students with whom I have worked closely, insightful scholars and wonderful people. The road really does go in both directions. And of course, many colleagues at UVM, Minnesota, UCSD, and Columbia, and at many other universities too. I could spend hours reciting what people have given me, but that would leave no time for taking up the second charge for this lecture, reflections on the current state of the profession. So I must simply declare my appreciation and apologize to everyone for not delving into details. Before closing this autobiography, though, I'd like to add 2 further reflections. First, some recent graduate students at Columbia, as well as some of my colleagues, have shown me how philosophers of my generation have taken too narrow a view of philosophy's role. A few years ago, our graduate students combined with some of their peers at Teachers College to begin a program of bringing philosophy into New York high schools. That enterprise has been enormously successful in helping young people, especially in places where the previous educational opportunities were slim. It's now been extended to philosophy programs to help people on parole. And thanks to our past president, Christian Mercer, and my colleague and good friend, Achille Varzi, to people in prison. One of my great regrets is that this didn't happen earlier and that I haven't contributed to it. My second reflection concerns 2 colleagues who are particularly pertinent for what I want to say today. Both, sadly, are deceased. One is Isaac Levi, who constantly pointed me in new directions, specifically by opening up for me the resources of classical pragmatism. The other is Sidney Morgenbesser. In the years just before his death, I would visit Sidney almost every week, and our conversation would range over a vast swath of topics. On one of those visits, after he'd read my book, Science, Truth, and Democracy, Sidney said to me, "You know, you sound just like Dewey. Have you ever read any Dewey?" I confess that I had tried and found myself lost, usually after about four pages. He told me to read The Quest for Certainty. I went away and did so, finding that Dewey had anticipated many ideas I had struggled to formulate. The next week at Sydney's, the wonderful conversation continued, and soon I was completely steeping myself in Deweyan pragmatism. Dewey will enter this lecture in a moment. Right now, I want to turn to William James. The sentence from which I've drawn my title is the third and last of a short paragraph. It reads, "The whole function of philosophy ought to be to find out what definite difference it will make to you and me at definite instants of our life if this world formula or that world formula be the true one." That sentence is far less often quoted than its predecessor, which presents a theme many scholars have seen as central to the pragmatist movement, the idea of there being no difference that doesn't make a difference to somebody, somehow, somewhere, and somewhen. The three sentences of that paragraph were important to James. They all occur in a much longer passage in the lecture in which he initially announced the pragmatic method, a lecture delivered almost a decade earlier than his pragmatism lectures at what was then known as the University of California. Even more explicitly in that earlier lecture, James's goal is to point out how philosophical disputes can easily collapse into insignificance, how philosophers can go on talking indefinitely about topics that have not the slightest bearing on the lives of other people, not only on the lives of the kinds of people with whom I grew up, but also the lives of my non-philosophical friends and colleagues at the universities at which I taught. Contrary to some interpreters of the pragmatists, James's dominant concern isn't to present some improved theory of meaning. He didn't have advanced access to Michael Dummett's thesis that the theory of meaning lies at the heart of contemporary philosophy. James's target was much more straightforward. In his view, a lot of the philosophy he knew was insignificant, unimportant, not worth the time of talented and industrious people. Pragmatism, as he conceived it, would reform that. James wasn't alone in feeling a need to scrutinize the worth of philosophical projects. Hume's memorable challenge at the end of The Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding would be echoed a decade or so after James's death in the logical positivist campaign for the elimination of metaphysics. But I want in particular to focus on Dewey's version of the Jamesian demand. For Dewey, even more clearly than James, does not tie his critique to the view that much of philosophy is, strictly speaking, meaningless. Democracy and Education charges that philosophy may not only suffer from being merely verbal, but also become a sentimental indulgence for a few. The charge was amplified 5 years later in Reconstruction in Philosophy. There, Dewey recognized how academic life represents a social division of labor. The division, he thinks, only proves healthy when those who pursue theory and knowledge are in unobstructed cooperation with other social occupations, sensitive to others' problems and transmitting results to them for wider application in action. Without such connection, inquiry easily degenerates into sterile specialization, a kind of intellectual busy work carried on by socially absent-minded men. When these people are challenged on the point, their occupation is rationalized under the lofty name of devotion to truth for its own sake. A decade or so ago, I elaborated Dewey's thesis in the context of contemporary philosophy in the English-speaking world. Although my essay, Philosophy Inside Out, seems to have struck a chord with some readers, it has surely appeared to most others as the conclusive piece of evidence, the smoking gun, showing me to be a philosophical Philistine. I compared some popular enterprises unfavorably with others that are often regarded as peripheral, perhaps worthy enough, but not really core philosophy. So, for example, my distaste for attempts to present necessary and sufficient conditions for knowledge, and for other debates dominated by a tangle of isms, contrasted with my enthusiasm for discussions of questions about race and gender, for attempts to develop a methodology for causal analyses of statistical data, for studies of rationality and its limits, and for the genre of philosophical writing about literature and music inspired by Stanley Cavell. My primary purpose today isn't to renew the negative case, but to respond positively to the most thoughtful rejoinder offered by people who have found my case wrong-headed and even offensive. And I'll apologize for any past lack of tact on my part. Yet before I proceed with that task, it's worth offering a brief update on the phenomena to which I pointed. Today, at a time when political discussions are clouded by talk of alternative facts, one might have thought that philosophical clarification of such claims could help. It seems to me, however, that most of the work in core analytic epistemology is quite unhelpful for these purposes. Where philosophical illumination does come and has come is in work that's either socially and historically informed, investigations of propaganda, for example, or from formal social epistemology, studies of the ways in which information and misinformation flow through different kinds of social networks. Contrast that situation with the one obtaining in philosophical studies of race. The sophistication of the contributions that have been made in this area, by philosophers developing critical race theory, by eliminativists, by social constructivists, and by those exploring the biological and demographic phenomena underlying attempts to draw racial divisions, has increased enormously in the last 30 years. Thanks to a whole alphabet of philosophers, from Anthony Appiah at the beginning to Naomi Zack at the end, with people like our president, Tommy Shelby, in between. Not only has the understanding of race and racism been decisively advanced, but there's good reason to think the progress has had an impact on some public discussions. Today, I come to praise philosophy, not to bury it. During the years since I wrote Philosophy Inside Out, a higher proportion of American philosophers have written articles and books illuminating issues for a broader public. Besides the examples I've already mentioned, other obvious ones include the many contributions offered by philosophers of all ages and with many different perspectives in the New York Times' Stone column, Laurie Paul's studies of transformative experience, Susan Neiman's reflections on coming to terms with a nation's horrific past, and the important work on epistemic justice pioneered by our vice president, Miranda Fricker. The health of the social division of labor is far better than it was a decade ago. So I'm less dyspeptic than I used to be. In the interests of revealing myself to be a reforming character, a philosophical Philistine on the road to finer appreciation, I want to take up a line of thought suggested by people who believe I debase philosophy in the search for extra philosophical relevance. That will lead me, I hope, to a deeper diagnosis of the pathologies I tried earlier to identify, and to a celebration of philosophy and its progress, and to a more inclusive proposal about what we ought to be doing. So far, I've concentrated on the attitude presented by James in the paragraph from which I've drawn my title. The real importance for today, though, lies in that final sentence, specifically in the question it attempts to answer. What is the whole function of philosophy? James's own answer probably strikes you as rather odd. At least I hope it does. References to world formulas conjure up disconcerting images, inviting us to think of earnest seekers climbing mountains to receive from the solitary guru at the top the one-sentence answer to the ultimate question. James's position can be clarified by following a thread leading from James' very earliest writings to the opening lecture of Pragmatism. The sentiment of rationality, very early paper of James's, already foreshadows the later view of the whole function of philosophy. What is the task which philosophers set themselves to perform, and why do they philosophize at all? Almost everyone will immediately reply, they desire to attain a conception of the frame of things, which shall, on the whole, be more rational than that somewhat chaotic view which everyone, by nature, carries about with him under his hat. In the first lecture of Pragmatism, the thought is further developed by taking these individual conceptions of the frame of things to have links to two major types of philosophical temperaments, the tough and the tender-minded. So in the passage on which I'm focusing, world formula appears to refer to articulations and elaborations of these temperaments, philosophical systems whose deliverances may help people improve and refine the muddled, somewhat chaotic approaches to life they carry about under their hats. The dedication to the Pragmatism lectures hails John Stuart Mill as our leader were he alive today, and I detect Mill's influence on James's proposals. On Liberty celebrates individual projects or plans of life, as later philosophers like Bernard Williams and John Rawls would call them. Our free choice and pursuit of our projects constitutes, Mill claims, the only freedom worthy of the name. His insistence on multiplying experiments of living points to a suggestion about how autonomous and intelligent choices are made through recognition of the diverse ways in which people think of the world they inhabit and of their place in it, and subsequent attempts to derive an identity suited to the nascent individual. James adds to this picture the sensible thought that the resultant conceptions are likely to be something of a mess. Philosophy tries to proceed more systematically. It attempts to develop overarching accounts of how things in the broadest sense of the term hang together in the broadest sense of the term, to use Wilfred Sellers's influential and much-cited characterization of the aim of philosophy. James steps back from that creative project to recognize more modest goals. In the spirit of pragmatism, he supposes that the grand ventures are worthwhile only if they're connected with human lives, if they make a difference to somebody, somehow, somewhere, and somewhen. If chaotic conceptions are to be improved, people need to see how the large synthetic schemes, assumed to be articulations of two major types of temperament, bear on their decisions and actions. I'm going to want to clarify and refine this picture. But even in the outline I've given so far, it will help me to respond to the thoughtful line of criticism to which I've referred. Readers of Philosophy Inside Out have noted how that paper conceives of philosophical relevance in a very direct and thus restricted way. Other areas of inquiry have a problem. They send for the philosopher in much the way a homeowner might send for a plumber. Or, quite often, actually, the philosopher turns up uninvited. My critics rightly point to the many occasions on which successful research in coping with difficulties comes about in a much more roundabout way. My own favorite instance derives from the history of genetics. After the rediscovery of Mendel's laws in 1900, some geneticists were eager to apply the new approach to fathom hereditary human disease. Over a century later, in our own age, many important advances have been made in this area. They didn't emerge, however, from any direct assault on the problem, but from a long and circuitous route through basic science, through developing genetic tools applicable first to fruit flies, to yeast, bacteria, and bacteriophage, through the identification of DNA as the hereditary material in most organisms, through understanding the molecular structure of DNA, cracking the genetic code, and finally discovering precise techniques of gene mapping and sequencing. We should all want to applaud the work that T.H. Morgan and his students did on fruit flies at the very beginning of this, in the fly room at Columbia. It's about 200 yards in that direction. And by the same token, it suggested we shouldn't dismiss the efforts of philosophers who tackle core questions, often in ways quite remote from the urgent demands of the age. There is, I think, genuine insight in this objection. Some philosophical projects without any direct bearing on extra philosophical questions can be justified. Obvious examples occur in aesthetics and in the philosophy of science, where more abstract questions about artworks and aesthetic experience on the one hand, or about confirmation and causation on the other, can be expected to feed back into research that will illuminate particular types of works of art or prove valuable in clarifying urgent scientific controversies. As I'm going to suggest, the most insightful contributions to the history of philosophy can be given a parallel defense. Nevertheless, to concede these points is not to issue a blank check. When you turn to the kinds of philosophical cottage industries I've targeted, efforts to give necessary and sufficient conditions for S knows that P, large swaths of analytic epistemology, analytic metaphysics, and analytic metaethics, any such evident connection vanishes. Is it reasonable to maintain that discussions of ever more far-fetched hypothetical scenarios will eventually contribute enhanced abilities to advance human knowledge, or the type of understanding metaphysics is supposed, wrongly I think, to provide, or to guide individuals or societies to better decisions or improved conduct? That strikes some people, including me, as very hard to sustain. I vividly remember an occasion at an interdisciplinary conference on knowledge across a variety of areas when, after the sole session devoted to analytic epistemology, the non-philosophical researchers drawn from many fields expressed their outrage at the discussion they had just heard. One eminent psychologist brutally advised one of the participants to find, quote, an honest line of work. That was cruel. But it wasn't hard for people with my past, within philosophy and without, to understand the impulse from which it flowed. We shouldn't spend our time playing irrelevant games for socially absent-minded people. Sometimes our cottage industries may need an industrial revolution. But maybe I'm wrong. Possibly some champions of the ventures I criticize will show how they help discharge the whole function of philosophy. Perhaps the champion will demonstrate their bearing on some particular field of inquiry. Or, more likely, I think, what will be shown is their pertinence to the function James identifies. From these explorations will come something, some thesis, some concept, some method, useful to people as they try to make sense of themselves and their world, a resource enabling them to remedy some part of the chaos bubbling away under their hats. I'm doubtful about this. Yet let me retreat further, reformulating my concern. What prompted me to write Philosophy Inside Out was a sense that all too often, questions about the worth of a professionally approved enterprise don't even arise. As I've just conceded, maybe a sterling defense could be given. What is problematic, philosophically problematic, I think, is that it isn't given. And it isn't given because the question never even surfaces. We get socialized into the ways of a profession, taking it for granted that such and such is a major philosophical question, even one for the ages. And people spend years seeking answers without serious reflection on the sources of its significance. That strikes me, as it once struck Dewey, as a profoundly unphilosophical attitude. I think professional philosophy can do better than that. In the rest of this lecture, I'm going to try to build on James's view of the whole function of philosophy to consider how. Let me start by using some themes from Dewey to suggest a more comprehensive answer to James's question. Like Dewey, I don't suppose philosophers to have some special source of knowledge or even some special method. Other academic disciplines, from anthropology and art history at the beginning of the alphabet to zoology at the end, engage in first-order inquiry. They aim at finding true answers to significant questions, or as Catherine Elgin has eloquently argued, to answers that are true enough. Part of their task, though, is to identify which questions are significant, and in discharging this task, as I've tried to show during the past 20 years, they need to acknowledge the predicaments and aspirations of all members of our species and sometimes of other sentient beings too. There are at least continuum many true statements about the room in which you are sitting during the time through which I speak to you, and only a tiny number of those, if any, are worth knowing. One of philosophy's tasks, I believe, is to assist the various areas of inquiry in their work of identifying significance, and to do so through helping people discover what most matters to them, sorting out the chaos under all of those hats. As Dewey memorably puts it, philosophy is a liaison officer between the conclusions of science and the modes of social and personal action through which attainable possibilities are projected and striven for. I do think that formulation still needs adjustment, but the figure is apt, for it draws our attention to the way in which philosophy finds its place among disciplines and among all the mess of the varied lives people live. Dewey sometimes puts the point vaguely but suggestively by saying that investigators within institutionalized forms of inquiry and in the everyday activities of human life find out lots of diverse facts. Philosophers, reflecting on these, are to provide some accounts of the meanings of those facts. I read Dewey's loaded word, meanings, through the lenses offered by James and by Sellers. Philosophy strives for some kind of synthetic vision. Perhaps that's done, as James proposes, by taking some existing framework offered by a philosophical system and showing how it bears on lives in the here and now. Or perhaps it's pursued through Sellers's apparently more ambitious enterprise, finding a new synthesis of what is known and experienced, one that fits the times. Dewey would, I think, applaud both of the recommended ventures if he felt either to be feasible. More thoroughgoing in his pragmatism than either James or Sellers, he sees the characterizations as ideals, and he views ideals not as terminal states towards which we ought resolutely to march, but as diagnostic tools for appraising our current situation, uncovering problems, and initiating efforts to overcome our difficulties. So Dewey, as I read him, diverges from James at the very end of the crucial sentence. He isn't allergic to talk of a world formula, but he worries about the idea of our ever finding one and is skeptical of regarding any such formula as true. Humanity needs the synthetic thinking which both James and Sellers commend as philosophy's task. But it is vastly overambitious to conceive this as directed at all-encompassing theories capable of being true. Think instead, he advises, about particular domains of human life, about the sciences, the arts, political institutions, economic frameworks, religious practices, education, and so forth. Reflect on what is known in the areas on which you focus and how it relates to other parts of human life. So, for example, you might want to assess the goals of education in light of the existing political or economic constraints, asking whether reforms are needed not to implement the currently identified political or economic desiderata, but rather to change the entire framework. What the philosopher supplies is a more general view, posing questions, offering concepts, suggesting useful analogies, putting forward ideals. If you read Dewey in this way, there'll be no mystery as to why he writes the kinds of books he does, unphilosophical as they seem to many. Books that are notably short on references to the latest journal literature, and in which figures from the history of philosophy enter only for the purpose of revealing how some idea, usually one with advantages and defects, has been introduced and has shaped the ways in which people run their lives. Like Nietzsche and Foucault, Dewey sometimes indulges in genealogy, doing so for the purposes of recognizing how we might liberate ourselves from constraints our predecessors have imposed on us in their own prior efforts to do the synthetic work he views as philosophy's principal contribution. Perhaps my sympathy for work in the history of philosophy will now start to appear more comprehensible. When I was a graduate student, historians of philosophy were often regarded as second-class citizens. In the intervening decades, things have changed for the better. The careful scholarship that's been done on the ancients, on Descartes and Leibniz, Hume and Kant, Hegel and Nietzsche, and on many others, has proven valuable for the fledgling synthetic efforts of our day. We return to the ambitious synthesizers of the past, in part because so little in present philosophy answers to the task they undertook, in part because some of their concepts and questions continue to seem relevant today. For history to play this valuable role, the historian must chart a careful course, avoiding any tendency to wrench the text to current philosophical fashions, reading the great figures of the past as groping precursors of our most enlightened contemporaries. I confess to committing the latter type of error in some of my own historical work, but that doesn't interfere with my admiration for historians who can consider past philosophers in their context, taking them on their own terms and still revealing ideas that speak to us. Let me sum up so far. Philosophers can do valuable work in clarifying and advancing the debates that arise in various individual domains of human life. And as I've noticed, the trend towards this kind of effort in the past decade has been encouraging. Beyond that, however, lies the enterprise of finding a general framework for making sense of the vast diversity of findings with which particular forms of inquiry furnish us. There are some 20th century paradigms of synthetic work, visible, I think, in Kuhn's studies of scientific change and in Rawls's explorations of justice and of political liberalism. And more in our own time, in the writings of Elizabeth Anderson, Anthony Appiah, Nancy Cartwright, Alexander Nehamas, and Martha Nussbaum, to name five very different contemporary philosophers. Such efforts, I believe, are much rarer than they should be. Our association contains many members whose analytic skills, whose powers of dissecting arguments, exceed those of the great figures in the history of philosophy. But the scope of their vision is constricted by comparison with the giants of the past. You might protest, of course, seeing me as advocating a vaulting ambition inappropriate to our times and inappropriate for me to engage in, since I've criticized others on those grounds. Indeed, the world in which we live grows ever more complicated. Nobody today can hope to write as intelligently on so many topics as Aristotle did. Yet there's surely room for smaller syntheses like those undertaken by the people to whom I've gestured, or perhaps for collaborative efforts in which philosophers with different interests and different areas of expertise combine. For, as in the past, when the writings of figures like Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, Mill, Marx, and Russell were hungrily devoured by large numbers of people who didn't think of themselves as philosophers, there's a genuine need for systematic thinking. If people trained in philosophy don't do it, it may be done partially and implicitly, but often, I think, helpfully, by artists and scholars in other fields. But the writers who advertise themselves as doing it more grandly, those who claim to renew the legacy of the philosophical past, are likely, if they lack serious philosophical training, to do it badly, even when the hungry public consumes what they supply. You don't need to believe in a comprehensive world formula, some philosophical analog of Newton's dream for a fully unified science, to take up the synthetic venture. You need simply to recognize the wisdom expressed by Margaret Wilcox, the protagonist of E.M. Forster's Howard's End. Only connect. I want to go a little bit further, just not very much further, but a little bit further, developing the Deweyan perspective. There's been a recent debate on the question of philosophy's progress. I think it's typically couched in the wrong form. Philosophy is identified as striving for theories, and the theories are intended to be true, but philosophers always disagree and the disagreements persist. Indeed, they are so long-lasting and so much ingenuity is displayed in conducting them that it would be folly to hail any philosophical theory as true. Hence, pessimism. There's no progress in philosophy. For some people, including powerful outsiders, perhaps a provost or dean keen on translational research and impatient with the interminable debates endemic to supposedly important disciplines, there's a corollary. In hard budgetary times, you can cut or even abolish the philosophy department. Why invest in researchers who never offer any new knowledge? My answer is straightforward. Because working in the interstices of the fields of first-order inquiry, philosophy helps all of them and helps humanity to take full advantage of their epistemic achievements. It does so by offering cognitive resources, not theories of everything or indeed of anything, but concepts, questions, suggestive arguments, and analogies. Those are useful in individual deliberations as people try to come to terms with the particular muddles that lie under their hats. In collective deliberations, as we engage with one another in trying to work through the ethical, social, and political issues of our times, in the pursuit of all those important styles of investigation, including the ones my tough-minded administrator favors most. To adapt another phrase from James, the trail of the philosophical serpent is over it all. Why do we continue to read the great philosophers of the past? Not, I think, because we take them to have offered a true theory, but because of the other things they provide. The argument of the Euthyphro and Kant's deepening of it is relevant to contemporary discussions of moral questions that confront us. The Aristotelian ideal of friendship helps us to pose questions about relationships on the internet. The concepts of the state of nature and the social contract are alive in our political discussions. So too are Mill's conception of liberalism and Rawls's notion of the original position. The retrospective test for the value of a life, posed by Schopenhauer and elaborated by Nietzsche, is one consideration thoughtful people employ in trying to figure out what kind of person they should be. One of the great insights behind Kuhn's seminal monograph, one appreciated by the many practicing scientists who have read it with pleasure, is its recognition of the multidimensionality of scientific practice. The science of a time isn't adequately characterized as a collection of propositions. As Kuhn saw, and as many philosophers of science have argued since, it's distinguished by its concepts, its questions, its standards, its methodological rules, its preferred modes of reasoning, its tools and techniques, as well as the answers it gives to the questions it picks out as significant. Think of philosophy in the same multidimensional way. Let's focus on philosophical achievements in introducing concepts, proposing lines of reasoning, suggesting standards and rules, posing questions, offering striking comparisons, and so on. When, as it happens, a philosopher puts forward a proposition widely accepted as true, it's likely to become someone else's property, taken over by scientists or mathematicians or political theorists or medical ethicists. These people develop it further, and after a while, the philosophical origins are forgotten. The progress of philosophy doesn't stand or fall according to whether the would-be synthesizer arrives at a true overarching theory. The crucial question is different. Do the efforts at synthesis generate resources that prove useful, whether for some systematic field of inquiry, or for collective efforts to resolve difficult questions, or for individual attempts to make sense of people's lives? I see the long history of Western philosophy as providing a resoundingly positive answer to that question. A century's worth of work in which Anglophone philosophers have largely turned away from synthetic ambitions makes that answer far less convincing today. Indeed, the unconvinced are everywhere, as with my Thatcherite administrator who plans to reform the university. Let me extend a point I made earlier. Skepticism about the value of philosophy is not only damaging when research universities trim their philosophy faculty, it's just as bad, maybe worse, when philosophy declines or vanishes from any educational setting. When community college students don't have access to philosophy courses, when there's no longer a major at the liberal arts college, when high schools think of the philosophy club as dispensable, when programs to bring philosophy into the prisons or into the lives of ex-prisoners are no longer encouraged. As I said, the philosophical world in which I grew up passed on a narrow view of philosophical success. I want to celebrate all those who have done very much what James commended. The teachers at all levels who have trained people to use philosophical tools in tidying up the chaos of what they carry about under their hats. In doing so, they have helped fulfill the whole function of philosophy. I'm not sure I can say as much. So that's a pragmatic argument for contemporary philosophers to show how they can contribute something more than clever solutions to puzzles of interest only to a privileged coterie. In hard times, administrators will ponder the value of paying people to continue what they see as an ingrown conversation. The line of thought I've developed from James and Dewey offers a more philosophical, albeit pragmatist, alternative. We should see our lives as making a positive difference to a project larger than ourselves, and so renew the grand synthetic tradition of Western philosophy. Thus, it's appropriate for us periodically to reflect on the worth of the work we're doing, whether it makes a difference, and if so, how. In my earlier effort to assess the current state of Anglophone philosophy, I focused on direct connections with particular domains of inquiry or on urgent social issues. That's one way for philosophers to make a difference, but it's not the only one. As I've suggested today, James's apparently strange talk of world formulas can be elaborated with a bit of help from Dewey to identify a different species of linkage, one to whose value the history of our discipline proudly testifies. Maybe I'm wrong, though. Maybe I fail to appreciate the importance of work I see as clever problem solving. Perhaps, though slightly less unwashed, I remain a Philistine. Perhaps. After all, as I confessed earlier, I left mathematics because I didn't want to devote my life to solving intricate problems. I entered philosophy sideways, and that may have blinkered my vision. Even so, as the history of philosophy reveals so clearly, sometimes a provocative falsehood, which may be what I've offered, can be a helpful stimulus to greater understanding, to the fashioning of helpful cognitive resources. It would be insensitive, however, to conclude without acknowledging the difficulty some of you would face if you were to agree and take seriously the main thrust of this lecture. Since 2008, many people who have just gained PhDs in philosophy have had to engage in a fierce competition for jobs. It was no picnic before, and given our current economic situation, the next decade may prove even worse. Nobody should expect those of you who are in this predicament to make your lives even more precarious by flouting the familiar unwritten norms of our profession. You can't afford to think big when the journal editors on whom your future depends are looking for ingenious original contributions to the current literature. Of course, you must play by the rules. It's only politic to secure your future before you spread your wings. Look at what happened to Schopenhauer, and he came from a well-to-do family. But I hope you'll retain the broader vision of philosophy when you are no longer so vulnerable. Many years ago, an eminent philosopher remarked to me that the great privilege of being a philosopher was the license to read anything. As I've explored parts of the history of philosophy, I've been constantly astonished by the range of the reading of some of our predecessors. Not only the obvious suspects, Kant and Mill, but also Rousseau, conversant with the latest zoology as well as music theory, and Schopenhauer, an avid student of Indian thought, and a reader of The Lancet. I fear that many graduate students come to believe that all they need to read are the latest issues of the most prestigious philosophy journals. As you pore over the current literature, I hope you will save some time for using the license our profession is granted. To offer that strategic advice is, I confess, unsatisfactory. So I'll add an important coda. Senior members of the profession should work to modify the norms, to find replacements more conducive to the whole function of philosophy. I end as I began. I'm a very fortunate person, and part of my luck has been a freedom to explore philosophy according to an evolving conception of what philosophy is and does. In what I've said today, I've tried to give some account of my journey. It's been a privilege to deliver a lecture named for America's greatest philosopher, especially if, as I hope, some of you are young members of the APA who will develop our profession in ways people of my generation cannot imagine. Thank you.